The next case is number 023172, Heffrick against the Attorney General.
May it please the court. I represent the Kaprich family. Mr. Kaprich is the petitioner in this action in a case that has appealed the denial of his application for asylum on grounds of lack of credibility. Mr. Kaprich is a Yugoslavian, Albanian, and Muslim who filed his initial application for asylum on December 7, 1992 with the INS. As the record reflects, it was a very crude, hand-printed application in which he barely stated any facts except that he said, my reason for filing for asylum is that I want to raise my family in freedom, and I do not want to fight in an unjust war against minorities and against religion. On February 22, 1995, the INS proposed to deny the application for asylum on grounds of lack of credibility. And thus, that finding set the tone for the rest of the proceedings that were to follow. There was a rebuttal that was filed subsequently by an attorney that Mr. Kaprich hired. It was a six-page rebuttal that was referred to, quote-unquote, as an affidavit. There were a number of other affidavits that looked like form-filled affidavits that were filled out by people who claimed they knew the Kaprichs in Yugoslavia and that they knew that his home had been destroyed to replace it by a post office. The rebuttal letter, however, does give some specific facts. In 1990, Mr. Kaprich, who by now has already served his mandatory military service from age 18, was asked to re-serve in the Yugoslav Army. He refused. By June of 1992, he lost his job with the Yugoslav Customs Service. In 1992, he and his family were forced to leave the apartment that they had been given by the Yugoslav government because his wife was postmistress in the post office, and the pretextual excuse was that we're going to destroy the post office and put a new one on the site, which eventually happened. So at this point in 1992, he doesn't have a job, he doesn't have a home, and he is being told from 1990-1992 very strongly to leave the country. Police have been harassing him, and if we all remember what was going on in the Balkans back in 1990-1992, the Yugoslav army had invaded first Slovenia in 1991, then Croatia in June of 1991, and had begun its attack in Kosovo, in Bosnia-Herzegovina. So that there was a campaign in the Balkans in that two-year period of ethnic cleansing and a specific government policy to force Albanians out of the country. When the application was denied, deportation proceedings were started. On October 20th, 1997, with the help of an attorney, he filed a new asylum application. And he had attached the country condition reports from the State Department for the year 1997. The INS, on the other hand, obtained a profile of asylum claims and country conditions and filed that with the Immigration Court on October 27, 1997. In fact, that was one of two profiles that the INS filed as exhibits in the case to give the judge some idea of what the country conditions were. What this profile did was give its idea about how bad and how disgusting Albanians were, labeling them drug runners, criminals, and people smugglers. The State Department report, the profile I should say, stated some of the following things. Dwarfing in numbers, applicants from all other Yugoslav groups are the ethnic Albanians from Kosovo and Serbia and from Montenegro. Secondly, the grim economic and social situation to which Serbia-Montenegro has been reduced poses adjudicators a difficult task in distinguishing meritorious cases from those reflecting the lure of a better life abroad. The extent of abuse poses real problems for adjudicators, for those dealing with large numbers of ethnic Albanian cases will note certain patterns in claims that might well be credible in individual cases, but in aggregate are not persuasive. Perhaps with poverty and unemployment, ethnic Albanians from the Balkans are often alleged to be disproportionately involved with drug running, crime, and people smuggling. The strong push factor impelling ethnic Albanians to seek a better life in the West, and the pull factor of large, prosperous, and clannish Albanian communities abroad cannot be overemphasized. But normally, the state profile says that they don't bring to the United States any documentation to prove their asylum claim, but when they do, it is shown a high incidence of fraud. It is this profile and its companion profile that's absolutely identical, except for the time period of the profile, once dated March of 1997, another dated April 1997. It is this profile that poisoned the judge's mind. And so he came out with what I consider to be one of the most unusually vitriolic assessments of any alien's credibility that I have ever seen in my long years of immigration law. I might also add that the State Department profile is the most outrageous piece of literature ever to come out of the State Department, in my opinion, concerning what is supposedly country conditions, sufficient enough to guide adjudicators as to whether or not there's any merit in the claim submitted by asylum applicants. I am absolutely perplexed as to why the State Department felt it necessary to influence adjudicators and why it felt it necessary to label all Albanians from the Balkans as drug runners, people smugglers, liars, and criminals.
The Balkans, well, they ascribe this to poverty and unemployment, didn't they? They didn't say this was the lack of ethical instinct. They described it to poverty and unemployment.
Poverty and unemployment, if it's a general country condition affecting all minorities in a country, is a relevant assessment. I don't know that that has anything to do with there being drug runners and criminals. There's a lot of countries where the State Department hasn't made that assessment that has a lot of poverty and unemployment. In fact, there's quite a few countries like that around the world, and yet I have never really seen something so obviously slanderous as that. My position on this poverty and unemployment angle that the State Department has presented is this. Economic deprivation can be considered persecution in a proper context. In a country such as the former Yugoslavia, where there was a dedicated effort to deprive Albanians of their property and their employment, and put Serbians in place in their homes and in their jobs, then this minority is being targeted unduly harshly, given the situation of grim unemployment as a whole. So consequently, it would be very obvious that even the fact that there's unemployment, grim as it is, or the economic factors are necessarily dire, that would establish a pattern which is suggested in the country condition report that the judge never spoke of, would suggest that Albanians were suffering disproportionately in a grim environment and being told to leave their country, leave and forced out of their homes and jobs. So that would only support, in my opinion, the claim of persecution, or at least given the judge a more realistic basis on which to judge whether this individual, like other Albanian minorities, was being treated badly in light of the grim economic conditions. I would not have permitted the finding that because of grim unemployment, these people have turned into criminals. I mean, that's just not realistic in my opinion. Not only that, the Balkans consist of Albania. There are Albanians in Albania. There are Albanians in Macedonia. There are Albanians in Montenegro. Which Albanians are we talking about? Are Albanians from Albania running more drugs than Albanians from Bar? And is it this Albanian that's doing that? How could he possibly rebut such negative findings in the State Department report? And fundamentally, what business does the State Department have in trying to influence adjudicators to look negatively on every Albanian asylum application? And dwarfing the numbers without telling us what these numbers are is an incomplete exaggeration of statistics. No statistics were ever cited, so we don't know if there are millions of asylum claims by Albanians, several thousand, we have no idea.
Could you tell me the country conditions report and the profile, what out of those distinguish between those two?
Well, the profile, I felt, in my reading of it, and I tried to avoid my own personal bias, was very generalized. Whereas the country condition report gave specific anecdotal evidence of how Albanians were being treated. It stated that there were random searches of Albanians' homes for searching for weapons, that the police were targeting Albanians for arrest, and they were holding their families hostage so that the suspect would appear, that there was a policy of forcing them out of their homes, out of their employment, and so forth and so on. I thought that, in my opinion, the country condition report was much more balanced, and at least it cited statistics, it cited anecdotal evidence to support what conclusions it had. And it was generally favorable to the respondent's case, I might add, certainly as compared to the profile, which I thought was an idle piece of gossip. The question here is there any support for credibility findings by this particular judge? That the judge was influenced by the profile is very obvious because in page 60 of the record, he says, once the respondent and his family had already received visas to leave the country, and since the police detained the respondent in order to search his apartment for visas and money, which I'm not too sure was really the case, it appears that the police could have been harassing the respondent for economic reasons. Well, this doesn't make any sense. The fact that he lost his job, his wife didn't lose her job, means that he's lying. That doesn't make any sense. The immigration judge goes on to say, finally, although the renewed application indicates that the respondent was stopped by the police on several occasions after June 1992, at the hearing, respondent testified that he was not stopped by the police again. It appears, therefore, that the respondent has created a fictionalized account of persecution was ultimately unable to keep his story straight. Respondent's ploy has been laid bare. The court concludes that his allegations are incredible and will deny the application on that basis. So this is a ploy, it is fiction, it is a dream story, and above all, the judge really exaggerated the facts of record when it found that his first application for asylum, which was hand-printed, three sentences, was a much better and more reliable account of his claim of persecution than the one that his attorney had prepared for him. Now, this really stretches one's imagination. There was hardly anything factual in the first record except his own desire not to kill other people and his desire to raise his children and his family in freedom. There was nothing factual, any more factual about the first application that would have given anybody a clue as to what were the circumstances that led him to flee. But he didn't have an attorney, and the application was prepared by someone from Travelers Aid in New York without the benefit of an interpreter. The judge said that the second application was an embellishment simply because the first one had been denied. Now, we know that asylum applications are denied by the asylum officers of the INS, and we know that they're referred to a deportation hearing in front of an immigration judge. And we know that at that point, it's more likely than not that they will have attorneys who will then be able to document the record going forward to give present country conditions and so forth and so on. And more likely than not, the attorneys will prepare the applications and it will be neatly typed. Very often there are extensive affidavits that support the application itself. So what is so bad about the second application that we would call it an embellishment? The judge was more outrageous when he said that this is not a case where an alien doesn't understand English, although he did attempt to have him testify without an interpreter, which was a really good demonstration of how little English this man was able to articulate in examination in a hearing. Not a case where aliens mistakenly omit important facts. Well, he found that these minimal facts were so important that they constituted overwhelming inconsistencies. And he said it was not a case where agents are psychologically unable to recount circumstances of alleged persecution. This is a case in which the judge was so prejudiced and so biased, and made so deliberately by a State Department report, that there isn't any potential for curing a record or a finding of credibility on the facts asserted. Yes, there are discrepancies. Yes, there is a problem with remembering dates, how many times. But on balance, if we know country conditions, that was a claim that was credible and it should have been given a fair shake by the judge and by the Board of Immigration Appeals. I have no further statements.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear now from Mr. Cunningham.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. I'm John Cunningham from the Department of Justice, appearing on behalf of the responding Attorney General. May it please the Court. My colleague has described a different case than the one the Court has before it. Our position is that there was substantial evidence in the record to support the immigration judge's conclusion that the lead petitioner, Mr. Kaprich, had not testified credibly in support of his asylum application. Further, we argue that substantial evidence supports the immigration judge's conclusion that even if it's assumed that Mr. Kaprich did testify credibly, that the claimed instances of harm that he said occurred to him while he lived in Montenegro did not rise to the level of persecution within the meaning of the asylum statute. Third, that even if assumed that he testified credibly and that the instances of harm that occurred to him while he lived in Montenegro did rise to persecution, but that persecution was not on account of a statutory ground. And finally, that there is no evidence to compel a finding that he had an independent and objectively reasonable fear of persecution if he is required to return to Montenegro. My colleague would have the Court sweep all of that aside on the argument that the immigration judge was poisoned by an allegedly inflammatory State Department report, and that bias infected the immigration judge's analysis of the record. As the Court has seen from our briefs, we have a jurisdictional argument on that point. Our argument is that the Court lacks jurisdiction to consider that argument, which has now been made the primary argument that my colleague has advanced before you, because Mr. Kaprich never raised it to the Board of Immigration Appeals. In his notice of appeal to the board, page 49 of the record, he said one sentence, the immigration judge denied me due process. And that's all he said. But in his brief, if you look at pages 17 through 26 of the record, he never raised any argument whatsoever regarding due process. There was no mention of the State Department report. There was no contention whatsoever that he was denied a fair translation of the hearing. By statute and by long-established case law, that amounts to a failure to exhaust, and the argument now being made for you regarding the State Department report, you may not hear because you lack jurisdiction to do so. My colleague, in her answering brief, argues that the futility exception should apply here, that it would have been futile for Mr. Kaprich to raise that argument to the board. Judge Cumming, I think you were on the Adir decision, which my colleague relies upon. That decision does hold that in certain circumstances, exhaustion may be excused if it would have been futile for the petitioner to have raised the argument to the board. The difference there is that in that case, in Adir, the government conceded, and it was clear that the government lacked authority to grant petitioners the substantive relief that they were seeking. Therefore, the court concluded the statutory exhaustion requirement ought not to be applied. Here, of course, we're talking about asylum and withholding of deportation. The board certainly had power to grant that relief. And if Mr. Kaprich had raised the State Department report/translation due process argument to the board would have had ample power to grant whatever remedy it thought appropriate. For example, if it agreed with Mr. Kaprich's arguments, it could have remanded and assigned the case to a different immigration judge, perhaps with an accompanying order that the State Department report be excluded from the record. It could have ordered a new hearing to cure any translation difficulties. I know here that Mr. Kaprich has at no time identified any evidence that he claims was obscured or eluded from the record because of an inadequate translation. Case law certainly supports the argument that if you're going to make a translation argument, you need to show how the alleged inadequate translation affected your opportunity to make your case, affected the record. My colleague argues in her answering brief that it would have been futile to raise the State Department translation arguments to the board because the board itself would have been prejudiced by this report. There's really not much to say about that, except that if the court accepts that argument, the statutory exhaustion requirement will be gutted. Because if you don't like the result of your case, all you have to do is say that both the immigration judge and then the board would have been prejudiced by this argument that I'm now making to you, the court, for the first time. And I'm frankly totally puzzled as to what remedy the court is left with in that situation, because if the board can't decide the case because it too has been prejudiced, then that leaves the court with the dilemma of trying to make findings in the first instance, which an appellate court may not do.
How about the claim that there's a pattern and practice of persecution by the federal government of Yugoslavia against Albanians?
There was the Ahasa case in the Ninth Circuit, Your Honor, gives you some guidance on that point. First of all, this is something the court ought to keep in mind when it gets to the merits of this case. This is not Kosovo. This is Montenegro. Most of the cases that I've seen, including Haksa, all involve ethnic Albanians hailing from Kosovo. And there is some indication in the record here that Montenegro is a somewhat different case, that although ethnic Albanians throughout the former Yugoslavia have difficulties with discrimination, that the problems are not as severe in Montenegro as they are in Kosovo. In Haksa, the Ninth Circuit cited the well-known and endemic problems of ethnic Albanians in Kosovo to say that, yes, it appears that this case may meet the test, the extreme test, for a finding of pattern or practice. And it repeatedly referred to, in its opinion, to the known problems of Albanians in Kosovo. We don't have that here, we don't have evidence to suggest, I think, that the same pattern or practice finding that the Ninth made in Haksa should also apply to...
Was this argument made to the immigration judge?
No, Your Honor. No, it was not. The pattern or practice group of asylum cases is a special category, and in Haksa, the Ninth pointed out that it applies only where there is clear evidence of an extreme and clear pattern of discrimination and persecution of a particular group within a particular country. And the Ninth was satisfied that in the case of all ethnic Albanians in Kosovo, that situation applied. It also in Haksa, the Ninth said that there was evidence in the record that the petitioner in that case did have specific sources of threat. It pointed to the fact that the petitioner had been told to report for an interview with the Yugoslavian police before he left Kosovo. And there were reports from human rights groups in that case that those interviews sometimes led to beatings and police abuse. And the Ninth, the combination of those two circumstances, the clear evidence of systematic oppression of Albanians in Kosovo, and the fact that the petitioner here had a specific threat made against him to report for this threatening interview, was enough to make a finding that the petitioner had a well-founded fear of persecution if he was required to return to Kosovo. We don't have anything like that in this case whatsoever. We truly do not. So my argument to the court, and of course we've made it in our brief, is that the entire due process argument that's being made by Mr. Kaprick in his brief before the court and in my colleague's presentation this morning ought not to be considered by the court because it simply was not made to the board. The board was never given an opportunity to address these arguments. The immigration judge found, as you know, that Mr. Kaprick had not testified credibly in support of his asylum application. My colleague has described the first application he filed in December 1992, and in considering it, the court ought to keep in mind what the environment is of a written asylum application. The the applicant in a case in this particular circumstance is not on the run from anyone. He's already in the United States. He has time to collect his thoughts. He has time to make his best possible case for asylum. This is not a case, for example, like an airport interview. Sometimes we have adverse credibility cases involving airport interviews, and there's some justifications for the conclusion that perhaps the alien was nervous, perhaps he was frightened, having just arrived in the United States, he's being questioned by a U.S. government official. But that's not what you have in the case of a written asylum application. The applicant puts in the application when he chooses to, and of course it's in his interest to make his best possible case. In that application, there were two questions. One, were you ever a member of a political party in the country from which you are coming? And Mr. Kaprick checked no. Second question was, were you ever, at any time while you lived in your home country, arrested, detained, interrogated by the police? He checked no. Then he had his interview with the INS in 1994, as my colleague has described, and at that point he said for the first time, I was arrested. And the INS officer said, well, I have a problem perhaps with credibility because you didn't say on your application that you were arrested. But in any event, I find that you haven't made out a case for asylum. At that point, of course, Mr. Kaprick knew that his application was on the verge of denial. And it's then that he put in his detailed statement, prepared by an attorney, as my colleague has noted, in 1995. And there, for the first time, he raised a series of new claims that he'd never made before, including the tearing down of his house, including that he was a member of a political party and that he was arrested while he was at a meeting of that party. The case proceeded from there. I see my time is nearly up. And that is a classic example of an asylum applicant adding new details as his story moves through the application process. And the law is clear that there is substantial case support for the notion that when that is the situation, when an asylum applicant adds details as the case moves forward, that those details are clearly designed to strengthen his case for asylum, that the asylum adjudicator has a substantial basis and can draw a reasonable inference that the applicant is not telling the truth. The other side of this coin is that in the Pop decision, this court stated that it's reasonable to expect an asylum applicant to describe early in the process, at the initial stage of the process, the most invasive and harmful event that occurred to him. And this claim of the house being torn down, this claim of an arrest while at a political party meeting, didn't surface until Mr. Kaprick had already been warned by the INS that so far he hadn't made out his case. It would have been reasonable to have expected him to have raised some element of those claims either on his December 1992 asylum application or during his interview with the INS, but he didn't. The immigration judge found that even assuming that Mr. Kaprick had told the truth, that he hadn't made out a case for asylum, I'll summarize very quickly. Mr. Kaprick claimed that he was arrested and detained by the police and held for either 5 to 7 days. He said that he was not given adequate food or drink during that period. At no time did he claim that he was ever interrogated, beaten, or tortured by the police. In the Asani case, the court found that a claim of inadequate food and drink was a possible element of a past persecution case, but there, the inadequacy was fully described. The applicant stated that I was given one slice of bread and one glass of water each day. Mr. Kaprick never explained what he meant by inadequate food and drink. The immigration judge certainly was not compelled to find that the judge had mistreated him to the extent that had occurred in Asani. And finally, the claim of the house tear down was totally discredited by Mr. Kaprick himself at the hearing when he acknowledged that the house was actually an apartment that was attached to the post office in his hometown where his wife worked, that he and his family had been allowed to live in the apartment by virtue of his wife's job, that the house didn't belong to him, the apartment didn't belong to him, that they essentially lived there rent-free. And what happened here was basically a case of eminent domain, which happens everywhere, happens in every major city whenever there's a construction project. Sometimes the government has to basically evict people in order to tear down a building, in order to make an improvement. My colleague has stressed the fact that the apartment, that the post office was torn down. Well, yes. And to me, and a new post office was built in its place. To me, that's evidence that there was no nefarious motive on the part of the local authorities to evict Muslims or to evict people like Mr. Kaprick. It was simply to build a new post office.
Mr. Cunningham, what's the current situation? Is there a Yugoslavia as we're sitting here today?
No, Your Honor, there isn't. The State Department reports in the record indicate that that Serbia / Montenegro claims that it is the successor state to Yugoslavia. The United States has not recognized that claim. We have relations of a sort with the Serbian government, but it's not full diplomatic relations. So as far as the United States government is concerned, there is no Yugoslavia. There is no one that we recognize as Yugoslavia. There is some relevance to Your Honor's point on this case, though, because the claim that Mr. Kaprick was would face persecution because of his refusal in 1990 to serve in the military, the government that sought to bring him back into military service in 1990 no longer exists. I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you, Mr. Cunningham. I believe your time had expired, counsel. Therefore, the case will be taken under advisement.